David Roberts has spent his life chasing epic adventures. For years, he climbed some of Alaska's biggest mountains, and he made a whole bunch of first ascents. Later, he became one of America's best-known adventure writers. He wrote a bunch of classic mountaineering books. And his latest, Limits of the Known, is a kind of summing up, an examination of why some climbers feel compelled to push the edge of what's possible. It's also a reflection on facing death, which is all the more poignant because Roberts, who is now in his mid-70s, has stage 4 throat cancer. He told Steve Paulson, there's no thrill quite like venturing into the unknown.
And this is what motivated me when I first started climbing in Alaska, the drive to find a place that nobody had ever been, to find out what lay on the other side of a mountain, to push beyond the limits of the known.
You did that for years, right?
Yes.
In some of the most remote ranges of Alaska. You had a teaching job during a lot of that time, but you say that climbing was what mattered most of all in your life.
Yeah, I went on 13 expeditions to Alaskan mountains, all of which were unclimbed or unclimbed by the routes we tried them. And in fact, at one point, we actually were able to be the first to explore and name a whole mountain range, the Revelation Range in Alaska. That's an experience nobody will ever have again.
There was one time when one of your expeditions, you were off for 52 days, totally cut off from the outside world. I mean, this is before the days of GPS and satellite phones and all of that.
One thing I do is I ask people, how long have you ever gone without contact with the outside world? No radio, no phone, no mail, no internet. It's rare when somebody will say 3 days. So I proudly say, well, I did it for 52 days once in Alaska, and it felt wonderful. But then I think of Nansen, and I think, well, what's that compared to 3 years?
And of course, the other side of this is that if you get into serious trouble, no one is going to come and rescue you.
Yeah, I think part of why that felt so good was that by cutting ourselves off, no radio, before sat phones, we became totally reliant on ourselves if we got in trouble. That actually, in the long run, ends up giving you a wonderful psychological boon because you don't have those worries about, well, will they come and save me? You know, it's, will we save ourselves?
So why did you do this? I mean, obviously you were doing things that were incredibly risky. You were putting your life at risk.
Well, the whole book is an attempt to answer that explanation. In particular, you have to reckon with the idea that adventure is pretty selfish. It doesn't, for the most part, do other people much good. You can't simply weigh your own feelings. Do the joys outweigh the sorrows? I think you have to take into consideration the people who are waiting at home and who will be devastated if you don't come back. It took me, believe it or not, took me about 25 years to see that.
You were just so obsessed with wanting to do this yourself.
Yeah.
That came before how anyone else was going to deal with your possible death.
Yeah, and I started climbing long before I got married. And yet I married young at 24. After I married Sharon, I realized that she worried about me every time I went off. And that actually undercut that wonderful, self-sufficient, self-reliant feeling I had, because then I would worry about her worrying about me.
So why did you do that? Why take those risks?
Well, you know, I think most adventurers are misfits in society. I felt like a real nerd and loner through junior high and high school. I went to Harvard, but I hated school. I was a math major, and I hated math. And the one great thing was the Mountaineering Club, which was the most ambitious college climbing club in the country at the time. So I basically majored in mountaineering at Harvard and ignored everything else.
You still haven't really answered the question.
No,
I'm ducking it. You are ducking it, yeah. Is there no answer? You feel compelled or you don't?
We climbers, we adventurers, really did want to escape the rat race, the petty pace from day to day, and get away from it all and get to a place where things really mattered, where the decisions you made had a huge impact and consequences.
So the danger is a big part of why you do it.
Yeah, you can't, you know, some climbers have said it would still be glorious if there were no danger. That's just nonsense. If there were no danger, it would just be a game.
Now, we should say that you have also experienced tragedy. Early on, one of your Alaska expeditions on Mount Huntington, one of your friends fell and died.
Yeah, that was in some ways the best climb of our lives. It was the best climb of our lives up to then, certainly. We made the first descent of the west face of Mount Huntington in Alaska, which was, we like to think, was the hardest climb that had been done by that date, 1965, in Alaska. And it took 30-some days before we finally broke through all the obstacles and got to the summit. And then just less than 12 hours later, we were descending, Ed Burns and I. The other two guys stayed up in the higher camp, starting to get close to dark around midnight. And we set up a rappel, and something happened. Ed rappelled first, and the whole thing came loose. And he simply fell right in front of my eyes without a word, disappeared into the void, and I was alone. Never did figure out exactly what happened. And then I had to somehow get without a rope down to the next camp, where I waited 2.5 days for the other two guys to come. It was the most intense, extreme, and upsetting experience of my life.
I can't imagine those 2.5 days, just being alone with that.
Yeah.
How did you deal with that whole experience?
I think I'm still dealing with it. I think I actually got a kind of PTSD from it, though nobody called it PTSD back then. But it also spurred me to write, and in fact, I had such an urge to tell the story of our expedition beyond just the journal articles we wrote up, that the next spring I decided I should write a book about it. I'd never even tried to write a book, but, you know, I was under such a cathartic drive that I did write The Mountain of My Fear in 9 days.
You read a whole book in 9 days? Wow.
Yeah.
Talk about compulsion.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe dealing with Ed's death, I presume, was a big part of that.
Well, it's the only book I've ever written under that kind of cathartic momentum.
Did you feel guilty at all about what happened to your friend?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. Especially because Ed was the youngest member, the one least committed to climbing. And what really brought home the guilt is that I went a month after the expedition was over, I went back to Philadelphia to try to explain the whole thing to his parents, who were utterly devastated and who didn't have any grasp of climbing. I spent a long, horrible weekend somehow in my self-righteous 22-year-old way trying to explain why Ed died doing this glorious thing, and it just didn't make any sense to them. They tried to find out why this was part of God's plan, and I stayed in touch with them for another 15 years, and 15 years later, it was as if the grief was as sharp as it had been the week they heard that their son was gone. Yeah, that certainly brought home the guilt in a lasting way.
You're still writing about it, still talking about it.
Yeah.
Ooh. You are now in your mid-70s, and your life has taken another dramatic turn. You have stage 4 throat cancer. I assume this has dramatically changed what you're able to do physically.
Yeah, it's curtailed everything that I used to take for granted. I can barely hike 5 miles now, and I can't carry a heavy pack. And it's a terrible loss.
Well, the other thing, too, is, I mean, you've spent your life dealing with the possibility of dying. And here, death is staring you in the face. I guess I'm wondering if all those years of climbing prepared you in any way for what you're now dealing with.
You know, I wish I could say yes, but I can't. I don't think they did. That kind of facing death is so different from facing death by cancer. One of the things I've sort of railed against was this horrible metaphor of the battle against cancer. You know, Susan Sontag wrote about this brilliantly too in Illness as Metaphor. Every time you read the obituary of someone who died, it's always after a long and courageous battle with lung cancer or throat cancer.
Right.
It's not a battle. It doesn't matter what you want to do, what you try to do. How tough you are doesn't matter. There was nothing heroic about it.
Hmm. Are you the kind of person who ponders the big existential questions? Why are we here? Do our lives have meaning? Or what's going to happen after I die?
I'm a complete atheist, and I don't believe in life after death, and I don't believe that that kind of existential question is worth pondering. But I do very much care about why we do what we do, and does it matter, and what's the point of it all. And I think for atheists, the idea that you might leave something enduring behind, in my case, my books, has a kind of superstitious appeal. You know, once you're dead, forget it. Doesn't matter if your name's forgotten, nobody reads your books. But I can't say that. I sure hope that somebody's still reading them 50 years from now.
That's David Roberts talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Limits of the Known.